Welcome to the Audit 15 Fund podcast. My goal of this podcast is to bring relevant internal audit topics to the table at least every 15 days. Today, I have the honor to have as my guest, Lynn Trung. She is the CAE at Dallas North Tollway. Welcome, Lynn, to the podcast. It's an honor to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me. I feel very privileged to be on your podcast, and I can hardly wait to start talking about our next topic.
Yes, absolutely. And it's a very exciting and in high demand topic. And the topic is how to reduce your audit project time by up to 70%, which is something that you kind of put it out there in the community. And I know you got a lot of interest, a lot of people who are interested in knowing how you did this.
It started out with the topic of a one-page audit report. And obviously, the audit reporting phase is one of the major phases of the audit cycle or audit process. And so it started out with just talking about the audit reporting, but we can talk about the other phases of the audit as well and how to shrink those cycle times. But yeah, if you can get your audit reporting down to a one pager, that absolutely will reduce your hours by several hundred hours.
There you go. So that's the first thing. But you mentioned up to 70%. So how do you get there? And I know that you kind of have a process that you want to walk through. So for the listeners here, I'm also publishing this episode as a video because Lynn is going to be sharing her thought process behind how to do it. So Lynn, I'll let you take the floor here and kind of walk us step by step.
Absolutely. So we're talking about agile auditing. And to be fair, you know, depending upon how efficient your audit function is already, what I'm telling you, you may have already been implementing pieces and parts of the advice, in which case the savings in time will be more incremental. But when I first walked through the doors here at NTTA, North Texas Tollway Authority, the team that I inherited was logging their hours, and they were averaging about 900 hours per audit. So I had a lot of opportunity here, right, to reduce, to cut, slice and dice, and streamline. If you're already efficient, then it may be incremental as far as what you learn today. But so I think the two phases that you'll probably gain the most efficiency from what I'm about to tell you is probably going to be the testing and the reporting phase. The planning is where I would want you to spend the most time, because if you plan your audit right, then the execution will be a much, much more efficient process, right? And then the reporting, obviously, if you go down to one pager, that will make your audit process much, much faster. So that's why the title here is Agile Auditing and the One-Page Audit Report. So let's jump right in here. And I'm going to assume that your audit shop is a risk-based audit shop, which actually the IA requires you to be a risk-based audit shop. So for my team, it was seamless to do risk-based auditing because I'm not only over internal audit, but I'm also over the enterprise risk management function. So I'm over ERM. So I know what the top risks for the company are because I facilitate that process. So it's very easy for me to translate the top risks and the changes in the top risks for the organization into my incorporate that into my audit plan. So this process assumes that you are aware of the top risks to the company. You incorporate the top risks into your audit plan. And then the next thing, a lot of audit shops stop there, right? Okay, we'll audit the areas that have the most impact to our top 10, top 15 risks. But I'm going to encourage people to peel back the onion layers even more. And once you decide that, let's say you're going to do talent management audit, because talent management risk is probably on everyone's top 10, top 5, et cetera, is now that it's on the audit plan, as you are planning the engagement, you're going to look at all the processes within the HR function that impacts that risk. So you're not going to do a blanket HR audit and audit payroll or, you know, how benefits are calculated or administration benefits. Those processes under HR, although they're under HR, don't impact that enterprise risk. So you're not going to scope those in. So you further scope, you know, do a scoping exercise of what processes to include. And you're only going to focus on the processes that impact the risk. So that will, you know, shorten your scope even further.
Yeah.
And then once you decide, yeah, go.
Let me just jump right in. There's just one question, clarification on the slide here. And you mentioned you own ERM process.
Yes.
So clarifying question for those who either they don't own ERM at their entity, at their organization, mm-hmm. or they don't have an ERM function at that organization. How would it be different for them?
Okay. So I'll answer the first situation, first question first. So I've been the CAE at organizations where I didn't own ERM. And in those cases, you're going to have to develop a collaborative relationship with the functions that own ERM and get that information, you know, as a key stakeholder, as a somebody that needs that information, so that you need to get information within the timeline that you need in order to develop an audit plan that goes to the board to get it approved, et cetera. And then you also need to have some sort of communication protocol with them throughout the year, whether that's quarterly or more frequently, in order to know whether that original top 10 list has changed, right? So it can't be stagnant and fail. Now, for this second question, if the organization doesn't have an ERM function or doesn't have an enterprise risk assessment process, which actually I've been a part of organizations that don't. Guess what? Internal audit becomes that first ERA incubator, right? We're unfortunately, because we need to know what the top risks are in order to be a risk-based audit function per the IA, you're going to have to facilitate the first enterprise risk assessment. And I did that at my first three CAE roles. And so either that becomes owned by you or you pass it on to whoever the CEO decides will own ERM in, you know, in the future. So that's how I would address that.
Perfect. I just wanted to address that really quick because some people may, I you know, it's different for me here, but it's an important step because that's the very step in the process, right? It's determining the big risks, the big enterprise level risks. So, okay, I'll let you
continue. Yeah. So instead of, you know, focusing on the process level risk. So starting with the top big risks, you identify the all the processes that impact that risk. And you're not going to audit every single process that impact that risk, right? So going along with that talent management scenario, if talent management is one of your top risks, which I assume is on everybody's, especially during the Great Resignation, then here are all the different processes owned by the HR function. And you're not going to try to do an HR audit just because you're auditing talent management risks, right? You're going to decide which one of these processes do it impact the talent management risk. And so talent management, those two words can mean so many different. You have to read the risk statement, right? And I hope that your enterprise risk assessment process has a more granular risk statement than just talent management. So maybe it says something like the risk or the inability for the organization to recruit and retain the right talent in a timely manner, right? Let's just make that up. So which one of these processes owned by HR impacts that? Well, I would say recruitment, onboarding, not regulatory compliance. Not saying that these aren't important. I'm just saying if we choose to do a risk-based audit, we need to use those risks as our North Star. Training and development, quality performance management. So half of these probably directly impact the talent management risk as in regards to the statement, the actual statement, right? And because we can't do all of them in one audit, we're going, in the spirit of agile auditing, you know, customer, oriented. We're going to just be speaking with our customers and finding out of these five processes that impact talent management, our talent management risk, which ones are the most pressing and the most urgent. And it could be other reasons why you scope things out for this round, right? It could be that for HR analytics, which could also help us understand where the highest turnover areas are, right? That could help us with talent management. It could be that we're about to implement a new system anyways. And so, Lynn, don't audit this area because we're about to revamp this entire process. So exclude it out for now. So when we did a talent management risk, after speaking to our key stakeholders, it was determined that recruiting and onboarding were the most pressing processes to include in our first audit of talent management. And it was indeed the very first time talent management had ever been audited in the history of the organization. So now that we've decided that we're only going to focus on two of the processes that will be impactful to the risk, then we start to drill down even further. So even within these two processes, recruiting and onboarding, that we've decided to scope in for our audit, because yes, they are key to our ERA risk, because payroll and benefits we're going to leave out because no, they are not key to our ERA risks. Then we decide, okay, what are the controls within recruiting that are impactful to talent management risk? And so there's all these processes, controls within the recruiting process. And as you can see here, controls in place to ensure candidate complete the EEOC form. You know, that's a very standard step in recruiting and onboarding. I guess that should be onboarding. But I would say no, because that's more compliance-related risk, right? Which, if that rises up to your top ERA, then yes, by all means, included. But that's not our risk statement, right? Our risk statement is trying to get people in, the right people in a timely manner. And so, no, it would not be considered a key control if we look at our top ERA risk here. And then these greens, these are the controls that would be relevant to our talent management risk. Things like, you know, controls are in place to ensure recruiters assigned a job requisition. Ensure candidate has been provided with instructions to get background check, you know. And then monitoring controls to ensure timeliness and effectiveness of the recruiting effort. So at every step of the process, how do we ensure each one of these steps are timely and done effectively so we get the right talent in through the door as quickly as possible? And so, as you can see here, we're further peeling back the onion layers. And even within the two in-scope processes, we're going to only include the controls that we consider key. You know, the concept of key controls is standard in the SOX world, right, when we audit financial statements. But we haven't yet across the board, at least not that I've seen, applied the concept of key controls versus non-key controls in the internal audit world. We tend to audit everything under that process, right? When we do a revenue cycle audit, we audit every single, I think, you know, in some cases, because we want to do completeness, right? We're afraid of missing out. So if you further peel back which controls are key versus non-key, that will then reduce the number of tests that you perform and therefore reduce the number of hours. And so you're going now from having possibly 12 different processes in your HR audit, right, to only two. And then even within that two, you're going from possibly a dozen or so controls that you would have previously audited because they were all included in these processes. But no, you're going to throw out some of the controls that are not as impactful or directly related to our talent management risk statement. And so now you're ending up with probably about five or half a dozen controls that you test. So that is the bulk of your reduction in audit hours. So going in, having 900 hours that the folks that I inherited were spending on an average audit, that right there, that process reduces it down to probably about 500 or even 450 hours. Now, the rest of the savings in hours will go into the reporting.
Before we go there, really quick, go back to the previous slide.
Yeah.
It seems like here's the secret sauce is right here. The secret sauce is right here. And what you mentioned at the beginning, that most of your time should be spent on planning. So just to clarify for the audience here, so planning is that selection of key, yes, no. That's part of the planning. And then the follow-up question is, how are you going about, and I can assume that you involve stakeholders in that conversation of like, yes, no. So, but just from your experience, what have you done to make that selection to be, this is going to be on the menu or not?
Yeah. So it's primarily, and it really depends upon the culture of the organization and the leader over the areas that you're auditing. If you've got a leader that is resistant to internal audit, like, you know, you don't need to look in my area, everything's perfect, I don't like audits, you'll have to get that information from the customers. So everybody at the organization is a customer to HR, right? And so you, if you can do some data analytics, if you have a data analytics function in during the planning stages and find out, okay, we have a pretty high turnover or we have a pretty high vacancy rate, and the vacancy rates are, the open positions are open for a very long time beyond benchmarking numbers. If you can drill down, and here we do have those numbers, and I do have a data analytics function. If you drill down per department, you can find out where the pain points are. So department A has the highest turnover, right? And the overall company turnover rate may be massaged by the functions that don't have as high of a turnover. And so it may look far worse in some functions. So you have to tease that out, you know, separate it out by department. And then once I find out where the pain points are, I go to those leaders of those functions that are getting the worst service from HR and find out, you know, what the problem is. Is it because offer letters are sitting on a leader's desk and not getting signed off, you know, which I doubt, because as a leader myself, when I have vacancies, it hurts, right? So I'm not going to be sitting on those offer letters. I want to get people through the door. So most likely it's not the leaders, but I'm not saying always, right? But you have to find out, where's the root problem? Or where's the holdup here? So let's assume that the holdup is because recruiters within the HR department are not finding people as quickly as possible. Now, it could be because they're overwhelmed, right? The Great Resignation, if you start out with three recruiters in-house and the number of job requisitions has doubled, but your number of recruiters has not doubled, then what do you think is going to happen, you know? So you find out these things through data analytics, through talking to the customers. You know, a lot of auditors make the mistake of only talking to the key stakeholders of the area that's being audited. But you really need to talk to both the left and the right of those functions, right? Yeah. What about the functions that feed information to the function that's being audited? And also, what about the function that receives information or services from the function that's being audited, the customers? And so through that, you can get a lot of information, right? Because even the functions that are very collaborative with you and say, hey, you know, yes, please find out what our problem is. You know, we welcome auditors. We want to improve. We want to get better. They have blind spots. They're not hiding anything, but even they may not know, right? Until you talk to the left and the right of them, the key stakeholders.
Yeah, great point. And so, great point, Lynn.
Yeah, yeah. So that's how you can find information regardless of what culture you're working in or what leader personality types are over the areas that you're auditing. So yes, the bulk, to your point, the bulk of the dollars, the hour savings, although that's dollars too, is going to be in the execution of the audit. I would say that the next area that saves a lot of hours is once I went to a one-page audit report. And there's been a lot of interest on this. So when I first came here, you know, the audit reports were Word document, you know, several pages, 10, 15 pages. And you can imagine the hours it took for the audit team to write in prose, right? Write in paragraph form. And then the additional hours it would take for the audit leaders to read and review every single word, right? And then the key stakeholders that were subject to the audit, the leaders that were being audited, they had to take the time to read those 10, 15 pages. and pick every word because they're afraid of what's being presented. So that process took so long, you know. Sometimes horror stories that I've heard is from the time you draft up the audit report, by the time it gets reviewed by everyone who's afraid of every word that's written, that's going to go to the board, it could take 4 to 6 weeks waiting for their responses and waiting for like, no, I want to change this word to that word. And sometimes different leaders want different words. And so it's a mess. And so here, you're reducing the number of words that's going to be picked apart. And the audit committee, the board, appreciated this so much when I rolled this out. They were like, Lynn, to be honest with you, I wasn't reading the audit reports because it was just too long. So making it one page has really helped them to be able to read it very quickly. And the key stakeholders, you know, the leaders within the organization that have to review your audit reports before it gets sent out, submitted to the board, they appreciate only having to read one page. The audit team appreciates only having to write one page. And it has everything you need here for to the board level, right? So it has a rating, which I use a process maturity rating, which I'll explain down here if we have time to get into that. But it has just a couple of bullet points you can write on the scope and objectives. Overall comments about trends, themes, root causes. You know, you can give more insight here. Strengths, always start with the positive, right? Here are some strengths that we notice. And then we can't list all the audit procedures, but here are some key audit procedures. We have this box here for management action items and their target dates for remediation. And so that's filled in by management. And so here, I've never had more than 4 lines of key observations in order of priority. So you're listing in order of importance. And this is not to say that you didn't find more than 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 items. This is just what we're going to view as important enough for the board. So imagine at the exit meeting, we have a discussion document with all the things that we found and want to talk to management about. And then from that list is a subset that we think this is board worthy. These items we want the board to know about. And those I've never had more than 4 items that's board worthy. Not to say that you won't ever, you know, but I would argue that if you have more than 4 very important items to tell the board about, maybe that area wasn't ready to be audited. You know what I mean? Maybe that area was so immature, right? This is the process maturity rating. Maybe that area was so immature, it was ad hoc, in which case I would recommend that internal audit partner with that area to do a special project to help them get more mature. Because you're not going to win any friends by sharp elbowing your way into doing an audit of an area.
And just kicking a dead horse sometimes.
Exactly.
I've heard that. I do have a question on the previous slide, if you...
Yeah, of course.
Okay. So question here is, how do you decide what makes it there? Like, because I see you have scope objectives, overall comments, strengths. How did you go about deciding what sections are worth putting there?
Oh, okay. So what sections to put on the one pager? Okay. So I'm just putting my board hat on and just based upon my, you know, 13, 14 years as a CAE, the typical things that the board asks about or are interested in. I mean, obviously, I don't think that you can get away from starting out with this was the scope and objective of our audit, right? That way, sets up the context of what we're trying to do so that it makes sense by the time we get to the audit procedures. Well, why didn't you do this? Or why didn't you look at that? Well, hold on. Remember, our scope and objectives was this, right? So don't expect any audit procedures that fall outside or don't support that objective. And then strengths, I'm a big believer in starting out with positives. You know, anytime you give constructive feedback or criticism, you start out with, here's what you're good at. It's like, And then it flows a lot, you know, better into here's where you can improve.
Yeah.
Right.
The sandwich approach, right? Start with a good, go over to bad.
Yeah. So that's why scope and objective is on here. That's why strengths made it on here. Overall comments, I think that can probably go now that you are asking me to do a soul search. I think that overall comments could probably go, and you could probably verbally provide those overall comments. You know, it's the end of the year, so we're in the process of reevaluating all of our tools and templates, right? And I'm in the process of revamping this one pager. And so you've given me some food for thought. You've challenged me on what I decided to put on here. And now that I think about it, overall comments can probably go. I can probably give that verbally. So thank you, John, for that feedback.
I was curious because we use a similar report. And I mean, mm-hmm. I'll just have it pointed as a discussion here because it may be beneficial to the audience too. Like you mentioned, having like strengths, right? So we use a similar report and we try to get feedback from the business. What do you like? What don't you like? And to your point, like areas that are being audited, that are being reviewed, usually they say, when I'm looking at this, one of the first areas that I go to is the strengths area. And maybe if you're talking to someone from like the risk management team or internal controls, they're going straight to what's wrong with it. So like different audience consume different information from the report or in different order, yeah. Right? And I do want to say one last thing too, which you said, one pager. Absolutely love it. I think it's something that there are a lot of proponents of the one page audit report out there. I did have a CFO who told me, I'm a one pager guy. Like I don't have time to look at, you know,
there you go.
They're like 15 pages. So for anyone who is a non-believer.
And you can tell. Yeah. When the board isn't reading your audit reports, right? By the questions they ask. It's like, oh, had you read the audit report, you wouldn't have needed to ask that question. But the other reason why strengths are good is not just feel good. It's also if you are in an organization with many, many business units or many, many different divisions, mm-hmm. the strengths in one area could be learnings, best practices for other areas. You know, especially if you are in a siloed area. And if you distribute your report to all the presidents of the business units, they can learn from the strengths too, right? It's like, oh, we're not doing that here, you know?
Yes. Best practices across the organization. Great point.
Exactly. And then finally, I'll touch upon why I put the related enterprise risks here with the colors. So this comes straight off of the ERA, which is easy because I'm over the ERM function. But based upon the rankings of each of the top ERA risks, we carry over those colors here just to prove every time we do an audit report that we are relevant. We're not over here in a dark corner auditing something nobody cares about. You know, every single audit report, which top enterprise risk, the very risks that executive management tells us keeps them up at night, we are impacting that, right? We are helping you to address the risks that keep you guys up at night. So we are relevant. It's a great way to be relevant to the organization. So that's why I think this section is very important here. And then audit procedures are really important, especially when it's a clean audit report where we don't have any key observations. You know, you don't want to run the risk of saying, well, did you do enough? You know, and then, so then this gets very lengthy, right? With it. Whenever I have, and once in a while, I'll have an audit report that's clean, but we didn't find anything. And then I really beef up this so that people see, you know, we did our due diligence, you know,
we
audited the heck out of this area. So, and
right.
This area is obviously for management to fill out.
Perfect.
But So really, that's how this audit report going to a one pager that probably reduced, going from like a 4-week process just on getting the audit report together, reviewed, you know, making all the wording, et cetera, waiting for management response, down to like a week. Huge.
Wow.
Huge difference, like game changer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So.
There you go. For anyone who's a not believer, right? That's, so you, great point. I know that you have a few other slides there. And
Yeah, if we have time, I can certainly go over why I decided to go into ranking the process maturity rather than calling, an area effective versus ineffective or bad versus good. You know, it's so binary, and it's so it elicits a lot of an emotional response when you use ratings like effective or not effective, or you know. So I decided to lower the room of the temperature. I decided to, hey, let's rate the processes that we're auditing on a maturity scale. And I got this from Audit Board, by the way. Mm-hmm. So you can Google Audit Board and find out this maturity ranking. So it's pretty objective. That's another thing. You know, when you're calling an area, you know, bad, you know, good, et cetera, it could be very subjective, and you could spend hours and days arguing with management on how they rank, right? But here, it's, look, do formal procedures exist or not? You know, are controls non-existent? Are there metrics? Are there performance monitoring? Yes or no, right? So ad hoc, and then repeatable. You have some standard procedures, but you rely on institutional knowledge. You have a few performance metrics, but they're informal. Things are highly manual. There's more detective controls than preventative. There's some subjectivity, but it removes a lot of the subjectivity. And so that way, when you're ranking the maturity of a process, you can say that, hey, you know, since this area doesn't necessarily have to be optimized, right? It can be managed. I mean, the payroll function doesn't necessarily have to be optimized, right? But if you're talking about the revenue cycle, that probably needs to be optimized. And you know, high-risk area, cybersecurity, the processes that you're auditing to address cybersecurity risk, that probably needs to be optimized. So you can kind of choose where you want or need to be. Not everything has to be optimized. So it depends upon your risk appetite. And then however you rank, or however that process is ranked in one audit, if they implement your recommendations and the next time in 2 years you come back and audit that area and they move up the maturity ranking, guess what? Intro audit gets to take some of the credit, right? Because if you implemented our recommendations, or at least we were part of the solution, right? They might have done other things, not just implement our audit recommendations. We can say we moved the needle.
Absolutely. Yes. And that's a great point too. And I think you can, some people, I've heard that usually internal audit, like how do you show the value? That's a way of showing the value. Like you're doing the review in 1 year and you go the next year, or, you know, 2 years later, whatever, and you're seeing that the process is improving. That's the value right there.
Exactly. Or if an area has performance metrics and you targeted that area, not only because, you know, it impacts a high risk, but you targeted that area also because the metrics are not in line with the target metric. The actual performance metric is you know, below our target metric. If you do an audit there, you have great recommendations and management implements it. If you do a follow-up audit and the metrics move up, right? Mm-hmm, they pop into the tolerable threshold. I mean, all things being equal, meaning if management didn't do anything else, any major changes other than implement your recommendations, one could argue that internal audit played a significant role or an impactful role in helping the company perform better, because we're now, our KPIs are now within the green.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's another way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great point.
But that's really the last slide I had.
Okay. So. All right. Well, really, really good stuff here. A lot of food for thought for the community. And there's no excuse for in 2024, if you're still spending a ton of time on your audit reports specifically, but also auditing what does not matter.
Yeah.
Time to rethink.
Well, if there are still some non-believers out there of the value of moving, or the possibility of moving to a one-pager, I'll be happy to take them on.
All right.
I'm a believer.
All right. Well,
thank you so much for having me.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you so much, Lynn.
Had a lot of fun. We'll be right back.